This is the 8th month, the 14th day of the year 2022, and it's the 10th Lord's Day after Pentecost, which the Lord hath made. Let us rejoice and be glad therein. Now, we're just going to basically try to talk about two topics here. I'm going to go over the first topic. It's something I posted up on the chat site this week. It's amazing. Every time you're reading these papal, the true papal letters of the true popes, they're so powerful. Our faith is so strong, and they hid it from us, which is so horrible. All right, we're talking about Pope St. Gelasius I and his letter 1 to the bishops of the East and his regards to the Cassius Schism. But in that one little letter right there, he's telling you the papal supremacy and papal infallibility. And it backs up, of course, the dogmas and what we have teaching about the fact that only councils that are confirmed by the Pope and areas that deal with faith and morals are infallible. The Pope needs to confirm it. Now, there's two fonts of infallibility. The ordinary magisterium is unanimous consensus of the church fathers when they teach on faith and morals, and those are all infallible dogmas. The unanimous, and that's the only unanimous consensus that is infallible. It has to be unanimous, and it's the church fathers. And the last church father, there's opinion as to when the last church fathers ended, like the 400s or the 600s, but no later than the 600s. After that, there's no more church fathers. Okay. So anyway, that's the solemn magisterium. But other than that, outside of that, then you have papal infallibility, which is the solemn magisterium. And that's when the Pope teaches infallibly. And whenever you have a local council, or you have an ecumenical council, or a regional council, called by Catholic bishops and presided over by them, and the council contains teachings on faith and morals, that's not infallible unless the Pope himself confirms it. Now, this is proof of what we're saying right here, because there were councils in the East that were not confirming, I think they were accusing Athanasius, for instance. Athanasius was condemned, St. Athanasius, by a council held in the East. And this council turned out to be a robber council, a fake council. But the Pope is saying that the Pope never confirmed that council, so Athanasius was not infallibly condemned by that council. I'm going to read it. But what he's saying is, if you have a local council, the Pope needs to approve it for it to be infallible. And also it says that the Pope doesn't even need a council to teach infallibly. He can do it himself without a council. He doesn't need a council. He can write up an infallible decree all by his own self, and it's infallible. And this condemns a conciliarist heresy that taught that the Pope needs to be in council with bishops to be infallible. So he needs to agree with the council of bishops, him and the council of bishops, to be infallible. Or he needs a council of bishops to even make disciplinary laws. It takes away from papal supremacy and papal infallibility, and it gives that charism to all the bishops in council, which is a heresy. It's called the conciliarist heresy. Anyway, this one little letter one, this little section I pulled out, condemns that heresy. He was 492 to 496. So it was between 492 and 496. And he's telling you, when you're reading this letter, he's saying this has been the teaching and the practice of the church for 500 years, which means going back to the birth of the church. Here's what he says. After 500 years, they, the conciliarists, intended to overturn the ordinances of Christ. That St. Athanasius was not thereby condemned, by the Synod of the East, because the Roman see, the papacy, did not agree to it. So there was a council that was gathered in the East to condemn St. Athanasius, but the Pope did not agree with it. So he says that's a non-condemnation. It don't count. The Pope didn't approve it. The Pope did not approve it. If, therefore, those who were condemned by the Synod of the East could not be condemned because that see, the Roman see, the papacy alone, did not consent to it, it follows that even without a synod, one who was condemned through the condemnation of the same see is condemned. What he's saying is the Pope, on the other side, doesn't even need a council. He himself can throw out a condemnation without a council of bishops. He can do it himself. That's the charism and infallibility that God gave the Pope. He doesn't need a council of bishops. Pope should take counsel. If you don't take counsel, then you got a problem with humility. But the Pope is the ultimate one that makes these decisions. This letter alone, and he says it goes back 500 years, part of the solemn magisterium, papal infallibility, papal supremacy. It condemns the conciliarist heresy, the Gallicanist heresy, and the collegiality heresy. which collegiality, which it was Vatican, Pate Second Vatican Council said that all the bishops in the world, if they teach, all agree on one thing, it's infallible, and the Pope has to agree with them. It's like they're putting the Pope in submission to all these bishops, not just in the council now, all the bishops throughout the world are infallible. If they teach something unanimously, and the Pope has to take counsel with them. So the church is being run by the oligarchy of men and not by one man, not by a monarchy. But this letter, you see how powerful this letter is, right? And these people don't care about the infallible traditions of our church, as you all know from your reading of my works. When the great apostasy began in the 11th century, everything started to go downhill and went downhill real fast. Well, there's one thing alone that condemns these conciliar bastards. And this Pope is telling you that this goes back 500 years to the birth of the church. And it's an ordinary magisterium dogma. And solemn, too. And we got many other popes teaching the same thing. I just wanted to pull it out because I was reading that the other night. And I went, wow, look at this thing. You know, it's all over the place when you're reading these things. So that has to do with the papal supremacy and papal infallibility. Any questions on that? All right, now, okay, what I'm going to do here, I'm going to say this also. I'm going to do a big video on this. And I may even do it on Christmas. On the just punishments of God that he and his chosen people afflict upon other people, human beings, death, torture, imprisonment, God requires this chosen people to mete out justice, to take vengeance for God. Like I said, when you're acting in justice and for God, it's vengeance for God. It's not because of a personal vengeance, a personal vendetta. It's because you're doing it for God, it's you're doing it for justice. But what I want to do, all these wimpy, effeminate people need to hear these verses. And the ones that are, that's why they're afraid to read the Old Testament especially. But even Christ talks about killing people in the New Testament. In fact, during the New Covenant era, many of your Holy Roman emperors and your Holy Catholic kings killed many people in defense of the Catholic faith and in protecting against heretics and infidels and the heathens. Now, we're going to go over, this is one really great, I'm just going to read this chapter. This is the one on Phineas. Phil, you know who Phineas is, right? And I'm not talking about Father Phineas, that heretic.
Yes.
Yeah, we love Phineas, a Levite. And because of what he did, God then said, because he did such this great thing in justice and holiness for me, all the priesthood will come from him. That means the active priesthood that can actually offer up sacrifice. Because you had lower priests of Levites that would take care of the temple. They would bring in the animals and they would do certain other things around the temple. But there were certain priests that were set aside to offer up the sacrifices. And they came from the line of Phineas because there's one thing that he did. It's in Numbers chapter 25. And it's a wonderful thing to show you about the vengeance of God, the justice of God, and how he kills people and has his own chosen people kill people when they're worthy of it. To get rid of these wimpy people out of this world, these effeminate Mr. Rogers wimpy people. And like I said before, too, we're not talking about Father Phineas. He was a heretic and a wimp and a weakling. Because he stayed in communion with these people whom he knew were heretics. He even admitted they were denying the salvation dogma. Yet, on his deathbed, he reconciled with them. He never really condemned them hard enough, and he never said anything about the other heresies in the Second Vatican Council. I don't want to go off on him to soil the name of this good. Here's this is a good Phineas, and his name's I think it's let's see what how do we see his name on it's P H I N E E S. So I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, but Phineas we call him Phineas. But I'm just going to quote from this chapter and have you absorb the justice of God and what God. So I still the spirit of martyrdom is twofold. To kill for Christ and to die for Christ. Kill, die, kill. Why do you think that most of the martyrs and most of the people that converted in the early church when we read the martyrology were soldiers? Soldiers are the most apt to convert because they're not afraid to die. They risk their life. They have to have a brotherhood among one another and trust one another in fighting. They have to suffer and sacrifice and they have to obey one person who's above them. Soldiers are prime targets for conversions. And they're not afraid to kill people when they have to. But anyway, let's read about this wonderful event that took place. And you remember when the Lord told the Israelites when they went into the land of promise, do not mix with the heathens. Do not marry them. And he's told them to kill them all. Because if you leave any alive, they're going to be like a stake in your eye, a thorn in your head, and they're going to be nothing but trouble to you if you don't kill them all. But he also said, You're not going to kill them all right away. You're going to kill them a little at a time, because if you kill them all right away, their land's going to be overrun by animals and vegetables, and you're not going to have enough people to take care of it. So I'm just leading into what's going on. So here they are now, and we're going to read about Phoenix here. But I think this happened, though. They're not in the promised land yet, even, by the way. They're not even in there yet. So that's just, they're on the other side. They were wandering through the desert for 40 years, and they're getting ready to go into the, so they're on the other side of the promised land, on the other side of the Jordan River. And they were still told then, even, don't mix with the Ammonites, the Edomites, and I think you also have the Moabites, and all your pagans and your heathen. Don't mix with them, because they're pagan idolaters. And you're going to get infected with their spiritual fornications, with their false gods. So this is what was already happening here. They were already beginning to marry within these groups. So I'll start out Numbers chapter 21, verse 1. And Israel at that time abode in Shittim, and the people committed fornication with the daughters of Moab, who called them to their sacrifices, and they ate of them and adored their gods. And Israel was initiated in Belphegor, upon which the Lord, being angry, said to Moses, take all the princes of the people and hang them on gibbets against the sun, that my fury may be turned away from Israel. So he said, take all the princes, the main people and of the tribes that are allowing this thing, hang them up and let them die in the sun on a gibbet. And he says, that my fury may be turned away from Israel. Because when you kill for God in justice, you turn away God's wrath. You avenge God and you turn away his wrath from a worse thing that God would have to do. You're going to read about that. So it appeases God's wrath. It makes reparation to God when you kill these people. And Moses said to the judges of Israel, let every man kill his neighbors that had been initiated in Belphegor. And behold, one of the children of Israel went in before his brethren to a harlot of Madian in the sight of Moses and of all the children of Israel who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose up from the midst of the multitude and, taking a dagger, went in after the Israelite into the brothel house and thrust both of them through together, to wit, the man and the woman, and their genital parts. He cut off their private parts. And the scourge ceased from the children of Israel. And God then said, okay, he stood up for me. He avenged my justice. And then so then God held back from kill. And it says, and there were slain 4,000 and 20,000 men. It wasn't because they were killing people, two of their neighbors. And there was 4,000 and 20,000 men were killed, all that were participating in this. And the Lord said to Moses, Phinehas. Now, people are reading this and go, oh, Phinehas, he's a monster. Oh, how could he have done that? Well, maybe it was kind of bad and kind of good. Good and bad, bad, good, good, bad. God gives this Phinehas now the greatest compliments and the greatest rewards for what he did, for killing these two people and cutting out their private parts. He says, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, hath turned away my wrath from the children of Israel, because he was moved with my zeal against them, that I myself might not destroy the children of Israel in my zeal. God said, if he didn't do that, I would have killed almost all of them. All the children of Israel would have been dead. If he didn't stand up and kill that person, and this is really bold too, because this guy was doing it in the sight of everybody. Therefore say to him, Phinehas, behold, I gave him the peace of my covenant, and the covenant of the priesthood forever shall be both to him and his seed, because he had been zealous for his God, and hath made atonement for the wickedness of the children of Israel. So there you're looking at the example of when you justify killings, you appease God's wrath, you avoid God's curses and more punishments from coming down upon you, and also it deters people from committing those sins. And when you don't do those things, all the bad things start happening to you. And he said it made atonement for the wickedness of the children of Israel by killing these people. And the priesthood, like I said before, was now given into him from his line. All the priests that were to offer sacrifices were going to come from his line. All the other priests were to assist in the temple and other chores. And the name of the Israelite that was slain with a woman of Madian was Zimri, the son of Salu, a prince of the kindred of the tribe of Simeon. And the Madianite woman that was slain with him was called Cozbi, the daughter of Shur, a most noble prince among the Madianites. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Let the Madianites find you their enemies and slay you them. Kill them. Because they also have acted like enemies against you. And have guilefully deceived you by the idol Phogar and Cozbeater her sister, a daughter of the prince of Madian, who was slain in the day of the plague of the sacrilege of Phogar. So how's that for God's wrath, God's justice? Who do you think God's going to do to these people that are putting idols up on the door since the 12th century onward, as they started to desecrate Catholic churches with these idols in their own churches? And if you go back and look at the history of the great apostasy, when that was happening, God was punishing them. Oh, there were so many plagues in Rome. There were so many massive black plague. He killed almost everybody in Europe. Why do you think God was doing all that? Because he was still trying to call them back to conversion by punishing them. Now, people may say, well, how come nothing like that's been happening since 1600 or 1700? God stopped punishing them, and they're still doing the same things, and even worse, because God gave up on them. They're no longer his children at all. He doesn't even care. He's not even punishing them. They're gone. When God stops punishing you, there's no hope. We read about that in Hebrews 12, 6 to 11. Whom the Lord loves, he scourges, and he scourges every son whom he receiveth. For if you be without chastisement, then you are bastards and not sons. So when God stops to punish you like that, he gave up on you altogether. But if you look back when those idols started to come in philosophy, the glorification of philosophy and mythology, there was a lot of punishments going on. There was the Western Schism. There was the Babylonian exile. There was the Black Plague. There was plagues and plagues upon plagues and punishments upon punishments. And they didn't listen. And most times people, I'm not saying nobody listened. Some people did listen. And whoever didn't spoke up, I'm sure they were cast out, and we don't even know who they are down till today. Because if they found out, they would kill them. But anyway, you're reading this, and here's the other thing. This is the same God. He does not change. I am the Lord and change not. Malachi 3:6. And even on Hebrews 13:8-9, he thinks that Jesus Christ is the same, yesterday, today, and forever. Be not led astray by various and strange doctrines. The God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament. The God of Israel is the God of the Catholic Church. He's the same exact God. He doesn't change in his ways of justice and mercy. It's exactly the same. You mess up in a new covenant, you get killed the same way. Exactly the same way. Jesus Christ said that in Matthew 19:17, and as those were my enemies who would not have me rule over them, bring them hither and kill them before me. That's Jesus Christ talking. I got about 10 verses in the New Testament uphold the death penalty and just killings. So let this wimpiness of these people get knocked out of them. This infernal wimpiness, this wokeness. I'll give you another one too, and then we'll end it for today for another reading. And it follows off of this. Let me see what we got here. Let me make sure I got this. Okay, what was this? Yeah, okay, here's another one. Okay. Yeah, Suzanne and the Two Elders is a great story. What happened there? Yeah, that's a great one. I'm getting some messages in here. All right, any questions so far on that? And I'm going to go to my next chapter of some more wrath of God, which his own chosen people carry out, by the way. That was Numbers chapter 25. We're going to go to Numbers chapter 31. And they're still on the other side of the Jordan. They haven't entered into promise, but they've been traveling, and they're getting ready to go in. And, you know, many times I said that Moses killed even infants. And people, he killed infants. God kills infants. How many infants die unbaptized? Where do you think they go? Straight down to hell, to Gehenna, the highest level of hell. They suffer forever, separated from God, co-heirs with Satan, okay? And I always say that it has to do with predestination. In God's mind, he knows what those infants would have done if they were allowed to live long enough. They were ultimately bad-willed souls, just like when God saw you. God knew all things before the world was created. That's in Ecclesiasticus, one of those verses. God knew all things before the world was created. So even when baby Judas was a little baby, you know what God saw in that little baby? A traitorous bastard who's going to end up in hell. God saw that in the baby, because all things are known to God before the world was even created. So if God killed Judas as an infant, where's the injustice and sends him to hell? Matter of fact, it would have been more just, because he wouldn't have had time to commit sins to send him to a deeper pit. All I'm going to get at here is this: when people talk, oh, God kills infants. Yes, he does. Every infant that's born in this world is born into the house of the devil, is a son of the devil. Now, I love all people. Yes, I want them to convert. But when I'm even in a store shopping, I see a mother holding a little kid. I love all people. And I still want them to convert, but I'm not stupid. When I go into the store and I look at them, I look at that little kid, I say, that little kid's got devils in him. I'm not nasty to them. I'm very nice to people. I am. Unless they're nasty to me and they raise it up and they blaspheme, then I raise it up. But I'm nice to all people. But nevertheless, I'm not stupid. I don't idolize human beings. I look at these infants and go, that infant is an evil guy. That infant could have like a million devils and throwing curses down on all of us. And it's more powerful than the most strongest man in the world. That little baby, the witch's little baby. So, in other words, this should knock the out of you people, like the wimpy Diamond Brothers, that were got so angry when they talked about killing infants and all that. Infants are damned and suffering in hell. They're wimps. The Diamond Brothers are a bunch of wimps. Because they want to keep their followers. You can keep all your followers and go to hell with them. What do I care? What are we reading today in the verse? Luke 18:8, when the Son of Man comes, think you find faith on earth? So you want to play a numbers game, right? So here we're going to talk about, and to get you guys straightened out, that Moses, and there's several verses where Moses had to kill infants. And here's one of them. And I'm going to quote him. It's in Numbers chapter 31. Oh, yeah. Aquinas was the one who idolized infants by saying that infants that died with original sin are they're in hell, but they're happy united to God. So wait a second. They're in hell, the hell of the damned, he said. Highest level, the hell of the damned. But they're happy united to God, so that means God's in hell, too, with them, residing in hell. God's going down there, and he's and hell's there's a place in the hell of the damned where people are happy and united to God. This is what Aquinas taught. Okay, Gustavo's saying something here. St. Augustine thought that all humans, after the fall, deserve hell, including infants. But he freely chooses to say something. That's right, to show his mercy. Because God knows in his mind which infants are going to be good if they live long enough or if they're going to be bad. And the ones that are going to be bad, if he kills them in infants, there's no injustice. If there's an infant that's born that is ultimately of goodwill and God sees that his soul's going to cooperate with God's grace most of the time and be ultimately good, God will never let that infant die till he comes into the Catholic Church, becomes one of the faithful, and dies in a state of grace. God will see to it that that will happen. And if that does not happen, and that infant dies before any of that happens, then God's telling you that infant was an evil bastard. He's evil. Okay? First of all, he's guilty of the original sin he inherited, which is a real sin, not just the character of the sin, a real sin, and they're really called sinners. Because St. Paul says, through Adam, we've all sinned. The Diamond Brothers don't believe that. They believe, like the Aquinas just heard, there's only a character of sin. He says, you can't call infants sinners. But St. Paul calls them sinners. Original sin makes you a sinner by inheritance. You didn't commit it, but you inherited it. And wisely St. Augustine says, and even that sin was committed by Adam and Eve and inherited by us. It's a real sin, not a fake sin, not a character sin. It makes that infant a sinner even when he's an infant. You don't believe that? You're a heretic. The Council of that's been condemned by the solemn and ordinary magisterium. Both. Okay? This idolization of children's got to go. Of infants, you know, you look at people when you have the faith in a whole different way. When you look at, I'll give you a good example. I'm walking down the street the other day, a little old lady's walking down, and she looked kind of like a witch almost, you know. I'm not saying she was, but like witchy kind of looking, real decrepit with it walking, and I had a passer, but I sort of went around her a little bit. I said hi to her. I'm nice to all people, but I'm not. I said, and I always go St. Michael the Archangel, defend me in the battle. I said it's St. Michael prayer. Because that little old lady with that cane could have a million demons in her. She could be a witch and could kick my ass if God lets her. If God lets her curse take effect, I'm dead. That little old lady with the cane, that little old baby that has demons in it could be your downfall because the devil can work through them. That's why I always tell you the most dangerous thing, human beings, you know, the beans I always tell you people to watch out for, not pinto beans, not navy beans, but human beings. They're the most dangerous. They're more dangerous than devils alone. Because devils, God can send them down to hell and back, but a human being, as long as he is alive, he has hope to be saved, so God has mercy on him. So the devil can work through them more often and easier. So you got to be on guard. You can't idolize human beings. And that means infants, too. You can't look at the little baby and go, what a cute little baby. You hear that? How innocent he is. What do you mean he's innocent? Well, maybe he didn't commit actual sin, but he's guilty of original sin. He's son of the devil. Imagine going up to people, but that's the truth. They need to hear that. Your child's the son of the devil. You need to come to the Catholic Church to get your kid purified. I mean, you read the church fathers, they all teach like this. We've been wimpified for like 500 years here. People are afraid to talk. But let me read Numbers 31 right now for you on this one. Moses killed infants. Imagine you caught that on TV, huh? All right, let's see. Now, and then also there's an unjustified killing of infants. And who can take an example of an unjustified killing of infants, which would then be, we call that murder. What's an example of that in the Bible? Of when infants were unjustly, there's two examples really. There's more than that probably, but the prominent ones. Where infants were unjustly, Herod. Go ahead, who say?
King Herod.
Yes, King Herod is one, absolutely. And then there was one other. Well, a prominent one, real prominent. Going back to the time of Moses. We just read about it today, as a matter of fact. Pharaoh, when he had the Hebrew infants that were all males, he had them killed.
Yeah.
We just read that today. So and Moses survived because he snuck them out, you know. But that was murder because that was unjustified. We know that because the scriptures tell us so. Sometimes God has pagans kill infants justly too. He can have like a Babylonian pagan king kill infants, and God says, I ordained him to kill those infants. Because God even uses pagans to do his killing. That's another issue. We'll talk about that another time maybe. But here's the one on where Moses killed infants. It's Numbers chapter 31, verses 1 to 18, and I'm going to then go over to verse 32 to 35 to talk about the justification of taking booty. Who knows what booty is? Booty is spoils of war. And that's not stealing. You're allowed to take booty, spoils of war. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, revenge first the children of Israel on the Madianites, and so thou shalt be gathered to thy people. So he says, Moses, after you do this, then I'm going to take you home with me, because you can't enter the promised land, because of the one sin Moses committed, where he couldn't go to the promised land. So God took him before that, on Mount Nebo, I think. And Moses forthwith said, arm of you men to fight, who may take the revenge of the Lord on the Madianites. Let 1,000 men be chosen out of every tribe of Israel to be sent to the war. Now here's a justified war. And they gave 1,000 of every tribe, that is to say 12,000 men well appointed for battle. And Moses sent them with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and he delivered to him the holy vessels and the trumpets to sound. And when they had fought against the Madianites and overcome them, they slew all the men and their kings, Evi and Resim and Sur and Hur and Rebi, five princes of the nation. Balaam also, the son of Beor, they killed with a sword. And they took their women and their children captives, and all their cattle, and all their goods, and all their possessions they plundered. And all the cities and their villages and castles they burned. And they carried away the booty, and all that they had taken both of men and of beasts. And they brought them to Moses and Eleazar the priest, and to all the multitude of the children of Israel. But the rest of the things for the use they carried to the camp of the plains of Moab, besides the Jordan, over against Jericho. And Moses and Eleazar the priest and all the princes of the synagogue went forth to meet them without the camp. And Moses being angry, now here, you listen, you're reading this, right? Hey, Richard, he didn't kill nobody. All the children were the children, he didn't kill the children. Now watch. Moses was angry because they didn't. Watch. And Moses being angry with the chief officers of the army, the tribunes and the centurions that were come from the battle, said, why have you saved the women? And are not these they that deceived the children of Israel by the counsel of Balaam, and made you transgress against the Lord by the sin of Phogar, for which also the people were punished? Therefore, kill all the male sex, even the children, the infants, and put to death the women that have carnally known men, but the girls and all the women that are virgins, save for yourselves. So there Moses is telling you to kill all the men, even the infants, and all the women that have known men, but only save the virgins, so they can marry them, take them to themselves. And maybe he figured why he allowed that. And they do allow that sometimes. They don't wipe out a whole race. Sometimes God doesn't want to wipe out a whole race neither, because I'll give you, that race is still special to God. If you trace back the Madianites, I forget right now exactly where they go, but they can be traced back to either a holy man or a relative of Abraham. So he wants to spare the race. So he doesn't always kill. But again, if you killed all the men, there is no race, because the race comes from the men. So we're saying he killed all the men that were taken in that war, but there were other Madianites knights that were alive somewhere else. So the example I just gave there wasn't actually correct. But sometimes he does say, sometimes he kills just the men, and he saves the women and children. Sometimes he kills the men and women and saves the children. So depending on what God's justice and what he decides. So in this case here, we see Moses tell him to kill all the male, even the infants. Now, 32 and 35 says, and the spoil which the army had taken was 650,000 sheep, 72,000 oxen, 61,000 asses, and 32,000 persons of the female sex that have not known men. And here's your booty, and they took their spoils away. See, there's another example of God's chosen people killing in the name of God for justice, for the vengeance of God, and not for their own personal vengeance, not for their own personal harm that has been done to their person, but because it was against God. It was against the commandments. It was against justice as ordained and decreed by God. So here we're looking at a just war, and here we're looking at the death penalty for these infants, male infants, and all the women that have known men. Okay? He's the same God. He doesn't change. They want to believe he changed now. They don't want you killing anybody. The United States pretends like they don't kill anybody, and everyone else does the killing. We're like the one, in the book of Apocalypse. He says, we look like a lamb, but we're a lion. We don't put it on TV when we drop bombs over the Middle East, over these countries, and wipe out whole cities. But when someone else does it that we're fighting against, we put that on TV and say, oh, look how evil this one is, and how evil that guy is. He killed a few people over here. When we keep people, we kill them on a massive level. And we kill them unjustly, like they did to the Germans at the end of World War II. The horrible injustice and what they've done to those Germans at the end of World War II. I think they call it the Holodomor or something like that. So that's just sort of, this lecture briefly was to knock out some of the wimpiness of people, okay? Firestorm, yeah, Holodomor and Firestorm. Okay, is there any questions? If not, we'll wrap it up soon. We're getting done a little early today, like a half hour early. So let me give everybody a blessing. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. May God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, the God the Son, Jesus Christ, bless you and protect you and grant you peace all day, and bless and protect your homes and grant you a peaceful week full of good fruits and good works, and good.
This recording was produced by Mary's Little Remnant, 302 East Joffrey Street, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, 87901-2878. And can be accessed on my St. John the Baptist website at www.johnthebaptist.us.